From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. The COVID-19 pandemic has forced many North Carolina families to learn quickly about online education. The head of an online public university in North Carolina offers some helpful hints. Tens of thousands of people in the state have signed on to a social media group dubbed Reopen NC. You'll hear a lead organizer explain why the group is protesting recent government actions. Before the pandemic, entrepreneur and school choice advocate Bob Luddy was touting the benefits of excellent schools for community development. You'll learn why. And a locker room talk segment will focus on media response to the pandemic. Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
As of late April, North Carolinians continued under a statewide stay-at-home order imposed by Governor Roy Cooper in response to the COVID-19 pandemic. But around North Carolina, groups of residents echoed their concerns about their economic livelihoods under the order. Some even protested around the governor's mansion in Raleigh to make their voices heard. One of the observers to all of this is Becky Gray. She is a senior vice president at the John Locke Foundation, a frequent guest here on Carolina Journal Radio. Becky, welcome back. Hope
you're
doing well.
Yes, indeed.
The message of the protesters who are talking about reviving our economy, what's your take on what they're trying to communicate to the governor and other officials?
I think they're, you know, what they're trying to communicate is their very deep frustration as this thing goes on. I think it's important to note that, you know, there are other movements similar to this. We're seeing this across the country. The North Carolina movement is very organic. It started with a Facebook page and somebody saying, hey, you know, I'm really frustrated with this. I'm out of work. I have friends that are out of work. Anybody else share my concerns with this? Well, all of a sudden, you know, they have tens of thousands now on the Facebook page. There were thousands of people who have come to Raleigh to express their frustration as well. The message that I think they're trying to get across is, first of all, public safety is at the first of everyone's minds. But we also have an economic health question and an economic health crisis. You know, imagine, if you will, and, you know, you don't have to imagine much because I think a lot of people who are listening to us today know exactly what I'm talking about. You've lost your job through no fault of your own. You have no money. You have kids to feed. You have kids home from school who, you know, want breakfast, lunch, and dinner and other activities and those kind of things. You have a mortgage or a rent payment to make. You, you know, have other financial obligations. You are trying to get the unemployment benefits that you're entitled to, but there is tremendous frustration with that system. I mean, with the volume that we have, that system is so overwhelmed. You would rather be at work. You don't want to have to balance whether you can pay your rent or whether you can feed your kids. You know, you had a job. You liked your job. Having work is really the essence of who we are and the confidence and everything else that we have. These are people who don't want to be dependent on government. They want to work.
And in fact, at the point that you and I are talking, more than 600,000 North Carolinians have applied for unemployment insurance. It's staggering.
Yeah. And Donna, that number is going up as the qualifiers for that now are extended to contractors and self-employed people. So there's kind of a whole new group of folks who are now eligible, who are going to be applying, which puts additional pressure on this system. In addition to that, what we are hearing every day is that businesses are closing. They are furloughing employees. They are having to lay people off, whether it's a small business in Kinston or North Carolina's Department of Transportation and everything in between. So these unemployment lines, the folks who fall into this category, again, through no fault of their own, these numbers are growing. And the frustration is just let us go back to work. Open this up. Let us go back to work. And I think it's important to note that everything that I have seen, there is nobody who has said, well, let's just throw out the public safety and the public health concerns. Everyone has said we can do social distancing. There are businesses that can do that. If we can open up grocery stores with one-way aisles and 6 feet marks to check out or to limit the number of people in the store, why can't we do this for other retail operations? Why can't...
In fact, other states are starting to move forward. The state of Georgia is opening up some things. Again, with those public health precautions in place, whether it's face coverings or gloves or distancing, one-way aisles, etc., there are some states that are trying to get back to work. What has been really curious and in some ways alarming to me watching this is that as you have seen more people speak out and try to have their voice heard about their economic concerns for their family and what the future may hold, and as you put it so rightly and so well, through no fault of their own. Mm-hmm. I mean, one day you have a job and literally the next day you don't.
Or you own a business.
Right.
And the next day it's gone. Your doors are shuttered.
In the wake of that, there actually are voices who are pushing back against people who are expressing their concerns. And the narrative, at least from some, is that somehow or another, it is an all or nothing situation, that it's either public health or it's economic health. And I think reasonable people understand that's not the case. There can be a balance. But nonetheless, there's some vocal people out there.
Yeah, and we're going to continue to see this. And again, Donna, you know, to your point, it's not or, it's and. We can have the public health concerns. We can have the social distancing. We can wear masks. We can assume that responsibility for ourselves in many ways. And I mean, you know, if the governor or local governments want to put that into regulation, most folks that I'm seeing are very conscientious of this. You know, nobody wants to get sick.
And they don't want to,
and they don't want to
give it to someone.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And so people are assuming the responsibility. You know, if you go even to the parks that are open or out in neighborhoods to walk, you know, people, you know, go, they separate themselves, the social distancing. Yeah. People, you're seeing more and more people.
And you walk the other way.
Exactly.
You know, everybody stops in their tracks and you steer clear.
Right. And you know, the same with the masks and gloves. You know, you're seeing people choose to do those. And of course, we had a shortage, but it seems like the supply chains have caught up with that now. People are making masks. You know, kids are out of school, have learned how to sew and,
right,
you know, do measurements on cloth and how to fold. And, you know, I mean, you know, there are some silver linings on this.
There are. In fact, my stepdaughter, who is grown, has kids of her own and lives in another state. Well, she knows that we are Los Angeles Dodgers fan. And so sure enough, we get a little box that shows up on the doorstep a few days ago, and it's face masks and with Dodgers material, so that she knows her dad would actually be comfortable wearing that. But she is one of those examples of people who are just taking charge rather than strictly being fearful. She's taking charge. Her husband works in food distribution, is an essential business, is out and about in stores every single day. She makes face masks for him to wear, different ones every single day. She dug out that sewing machine she never thought she would use. That's been something we've seen a lot too. People just taking responsibility.
And I think if you do that, I think we've all needed some guidance from government. There is a core function of government, and I think we can all agree that in a public health crisis, there is a role for government. But I think, you know, all of this is about balance, and I think that we also need to think about personal responsibility and having the confidence in the American people that, you know, we're going to do what's right. Give us the opportunity, and we'll do what's right.
Becky, there has been one disturbing situation that has involved you personally and the impact of social media as people exchange their views as we all work through this pandemic. And it had to do with the message of getting back to work. And you are on Twitter at Becky Gray, and you are a frequent commenter on other people's Twitter feeds. And one person from the left took offense to something you said about needing to get back to work.
Yeah, it was, you know, again, you know, some of my tweets are, you know, kind of research based, and some of them are just lighthearted kind of interactions with folks. And there was a thread about a guy who had cooked an apple in an Instapot. And there was a long thread with all kinds of comments about whether you should or suggestions about how to cook apples and that kind of thing. And I just commented and said, you know, this is an example of why this has gone on too long and people need to get back to work. They've got
too much time.
They got too much time on their hands if this is what we're talking about.
Reaction from
right.
One
and
on
so,
the left.
Yeah, this troll, you know, said that I should be robbed of my platform to speak. This is disturbing. This is extremely disturbing. And so as this, as this continues, one thing that I've noticed on is it seems to bring out, as we've talked, the best in people. It also brings out the worst in people. And I think this is an example of when a lighthearted comment is receiving troll action like this, wanting me to be robbed of my platform to speak. I think that's disturbing.
Thank you, Becky.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment. Tired of fake news? Tired of reporters with political axes to grind? Well, you need to be reading Carolina Journal. Honest, uncompromising, old-school journalism you expect and you need. Even better, the monthly Carolina Journal is free to subscribers. Sign up at carolinajournal.com. You'll receive Carolina Journal newspaper in your mailbox each month. Investigations into government spending, revelations about boondoggles, who the powerful leaders are and what they're doing in your name and with your money. We shine the light on it all with the stories and angles other outlets barely cover. But there's a bonus. Our print newspaper is published monthly, but our daily news site gives you the latest news each and every day. Log on to carolinajournal.com once, twice, even three times a day. You won't be disappointed. It's fresh news. And if you'd like a heads up on the daily news, sign up for our daily email. Do that at carolinajournal.com. Carolina Journal, rigorous, unrelenting, old school journalism. We hold government accountable for you.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokine. As COVID-19 has forced many families to venture into the world of online education, John Locke Foundation has been consulting experts. What's the best way to make virtual learning work? During a recent online event, Catherine Truitt offered her ideas. She's Chancellor of Western Governors University, North Carolina, and an education advisor to former Governor Pat McCrory. Truitt offered some basic advice for getting started.
That first day of school, set our ground rules and our class rules, if you will, with the help of the students. And of course, as all good teachers know, the more input you give your student into that process, the more likely they are to follow it. The other thing I would add that, it's kind of funny, but it's true, is don't be afraid to bribe your kids. Not necessarily with the money, but find out what their currency is and do a little horse trading with them. They may be more likely to follow through with what they're supposed to do.
Truitt says there's a range of responses to online education among traditional classroom teachers.
Probably every teacher is at a different comfort level with this. And the best advice that I would give principals and superintendents is to find your teachers who are already comfortable and leverage their expertise in helping other teachers who are perhaps more of a novice with remote learning and online learning to just really help them with this process. We've got so many pockets of excellence across our state in districts that have been doing this for a while and for whom this was not a difficult transition just from a teacher point of view. But then we have other districts who have nothing in place yet. For many reasons. So I think this is an opportunity for both parents and teachers to be patient with one another.
Truitt says there's wide variation across North Carolina as school districts respond to the COVID-19 pandemic and online learning needs.
The districts who are ahead of the curve and who have been doing this for a while made an intentional choice to do this on their own several years ago. And so they found funding sources on their own. They leveraged private industry and got grants and so forth on their own. And it was really through what I would consider to be the visionary leadership of many local superintendents. I think that it's important to think about the fact that when we talk about who's doing what, it's important for everyone to remember that everyone's doing the best that they can with the system that's in place. Teachers in particular, I feel like they're kind of stuck in a lot of ways because they're doing the best with what's being given to them. They are doing the best operating in a system that by and large is not equipped to handle an overnight switch to remote learning. And so I think that when the dust settles, we're going to have some hard conversations about what this system looks like. Because if there's one thing that I've been just thinking about so much the last couple of weeks, is how much this is highlighting truly our system of K-12 education, not just in North Carolina, but throughout the U.S., that COVID-19 has highlighted that this is a broken system that works for some kids, but not for all. And unfortunately, those districts that are able to kind of soldier on and do this really well are going to do a great job, I'm sure, but we're going to see the digital divide increasing during COVID-19. And I think that's, again, something that we don't want to not educate anybody out of fear, but we also need to be aware that the digital divide is going to grow even more during this time.
That's Catherine Truitt, Chancellor of Western Governors University, North Carolina. She took part in a recent online event with the John Locke Foundation. Truitt focused on the need to modernize public education across the state.
K-12 needs to modernize, not just because we could have another event that leaves people at home, but it needs to modernize because that's the right thing to do. It needs to modernize because we need to go where the rest of the world already is. And the fact that most of the people on this call have probably been able to go about their daily lives, or at least their jobs, with not a whole lot of interruption. It's mainly inconveniences. I mean, I can still buy batteries on Amazon if I need to. I can bank online. I can order food online. And of course, I'm continuing to do my job remotely. And that's not the case with K-12, or universities for that matter, unless you're online like WGU. And so, there are a lot of challenges to flipping the switch for K-12. I mean, one of the reasons that, this is going to be so problematic for so many counties is because of access to broadband.
Is it time for North Carolina to change its school funding system? How about a system in which money follows a student to a range of education options?
The idea of the money following the student is something that a lot of people agree with on paper. If you say to them, do you think the money should follow the student? They say yes, but of course that's not really how funding works in North Carolina and a lot of other places as well. And I think that when this is all said and done, I would love to see some sort of convening from DPI to reach back and do a deep dive into lessons learned all the way from students and parents through to the teachers and the administrators and the superintendents so that we can create a lessons learned document so that we can start to address some of these issues. Because certainly there's a big appetite right now, again, because of the Westhead report, to look at funding in North Carolina, what our funding mechanisms are. I would also say that as far as teachers go, I think a lot of teachers would agree and will be gratified to see that one outcome of this crisis is going to be the fact that it will have become very obvious to a lot of people that our system is so focused on the compliance around learning that we've boxed ourselves out of the ability to be innovative. And so, again, hopefully there will be an opportunity to revisit all these things that we're talking about so that we can reset our focus on kids rather than on kids' outcomes, their learning outcomes, rather than just inputs.
What about the future of online education? Will it replace traditional brick-and-mortar schools? Truitt suggests a third option.
It's not going to be about either or anymore. It's going to have to be about blended. And blended learning that leverages technology in order to produce a personalized learning experience for the student is key. And I think, again, a lot of folks in the education community totally agree with that. It's just a matter of actually making it happen. And the truth is that we're going to have to do a fundamental shift in the way we think about learning and assessing learning if we are to truly create blended learning experiences for kids.
That's Catherine Truitt, Chancellor of Western Governors University, North Carolina. During a recent John Locke Foundation event, she discussed efforts to boost online learning in the face of the COVID-19 pandemic. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups across North Carolina all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. It's one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, opinion pieces and reports on higher education from the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Try it today.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation, and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Who knew you could shop and invest in freedom at the same time? It is true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate the John Locke Foundation to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop. Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. Here's how. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile is the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible Amazon Smile purchases to the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate us as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today. Buy something nice and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. As North Carolina shut down much of the economy in connection with the COVID-19 pandemic, some people raised objections. Thousands of people joined a group dubbed Reopen NC. Organizer Ashley Smith introduced herself to members online.
I'm a freedom fighter, I'm a libertarian, and I'm a constitutional conservative. And there's been a lot of discussion about the constitutionality of this shutdown. I've heard a lot of people say it is constitutional because once he passes an executive order or a state of emergency, that would make it legal. So what I'm going to tell you today is that I disagree with that, and I'm going to tell you why. The Constitution, it's not a document that grants us our rights. It's a document that recognizes our rights. It's a founding document that our founding fathers said was important because it recognized the rights that were granted to us by the Creator. So they're not given by man, and therefore they can't be taken away by man. They're not disposable in the time of a pandemic. They're not disposable in the time of war. They're not disposable at any time. As a Constitution keeper, I'm going to tell you, the First Amendment says, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press or the right of the people to peaceably assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. The fact that churches cannot get together right now, reach out to your church leaders. Why are we standing for this as a nation? Why are we okay with our freedom of religion just being squashed? We could still be smart adults and socially distance if that's what people feel the need to do, which I think should be completely voluntary because I'm an adult and I have the right to make my own medical decisions. I have the right to make a decision if I want to be tested or not. I have a right because I am a sovereign entity and my rights were endowed by my creator. So please don't misunderstand me. I'm trying to light a fire under your derriere today because if we don't all come together and get passionate about our freedoms and our rights, they're going to be a thing of the past. And in 20 years, I'm going to be telling my grandchildren about a time when America used to be free. And I don't want that to happen. I want us to come together and I want us to be on the phone every single day. I have been calling my governor, my lieutenant governor, my senator, and my representative at least 3 times a week since all of this started. I've only gotten through to the governor one time, so that's very telling, even to leave a message. His line's just been totally busy. Our elected officials want to know where their constituents stand, and it's how they do make decisions. If they're not hearing from us, then they just decide what they think is best. So if they hear from a united front on a regular basis, they're more likely to vote if it comes to a vote or to speak on our behalf than if they're not hearing from us.
That's Ashley Smith, an organizer of the group Reopen NC. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
We're doubling down on freedom. At Carolina Journal Radio, we're proud to bring you stories that impact your life and your wallet. And now, get twice as much freedom when you also listen to our podcast, Headlock, available on iTunes and at johnlock.org/podcast. Now, Headlock is a little bit different. It's a no-holds-barred discussion that challenges soft-headed ideas from the left and the right. But like Carolina Journal Radio, Headlock is smart and timely. But with Headlock, you'll hear more about the culture wars, and you'll get some more humor as well. We guarantee great information and a good time. Double down with us. Listen to Carolina Journal Radio each week, and listen to Headlock, too. Remember, you can listen to Headlock at johnlock.org/podcast, or subscribe or download each week at iTunes. Carolina Journal Radio and Headlock, just what you need to stay informed and stay entertained. Both brought to you in the name of freedom by the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Excellent schools are the best community development programs. That was the title of a recent presentation our next guest delivered to the John Locke Foundation's Shaftesbury Society. Bob Luddy is founder and president of Captive Air Systems, and he's also founder and chairman of Franklin Academy, St. Thomas More Academy, and the group of schools known as Daly's Academy. Welcome to the program.
Pleasure to be here with you today, Mitch.
So excellent schools are the best community development programs. Why do you think so?
Because parents are most concerned about their children and that they get good schooling. And think about it, the family settles somewhere near school, kids are safe, dad or mom can travel a little further to work. But they want the kids to be in a nurturing environment close to home. It's very logical, but it's also proven out by data.
Now, this is something you've been working on for a long time. Excellent schools don't necessarily mean just the traditional district schools that are run by a school board. This could mean a lot of different options, right?
Yeah, excellent schools could be any and all stripes that you can possibly think of, to include private, charter, faith-based, and to some degree, homeschooling and homeschooling cooperatives now are becoming very popular around the country.
Tell us a little bit about how you got involved in this process, because as we mentioned at the top, you are founder and chairman of some charter schools and private schools.
Yeah, back in the mid-90s, I became much more concerned about the educational attainment of many students. So some students were doing well, but many students weren't doing well. And that's when I decided to start the public charter school, Franklin Academy. And it turned out to be a major input long-term change in the community of Wake Forest, Rollsville, northern Wake County.
How did it help?
Well, it's interesting. Nobody knew what a charter school was in 1998, but we opened with 160 students. And by the following year, we had over 200 students, and it became the school of choice within a year. So I think anytime you have a new offering in the market, if it's attractive, the word's going to spread quickly.
What was it about Franklin Academy, in addition to it just being a new option, that you think made it so popular?
Well, I think initially we introduced direct instruction, which is one of the best methodologies of teaching reading, math, phonics. We had a small nurturing school. We made sure that every single child in that school at least reached grade level, and many of them were one and two grades ahead. So it was a very strong interest in every single student in that school. And parents noticed the difference. And as I tell parents consistently, you don't have to wait for grades. You don't have to wait for test scores. You're going to see the difference in your child in a matter of weeks in the school.
We're chatting with Bob Luddy. You could have stopped right there and said, hey, Franklin Academy's working. We're going to stick with that. But you also moved on and helped with some other projects, including outside of the charter school model, the private schools that are Thales Academy, that are now at least eight, I think, schools.
Yeah,
at this
we've
point.
Got eight schools open. So somewhere around 2005 or six, there were no more charter schools available because we had a cap in North Carolina. So I began to think more about private education, and I had a small meeting in our corporate office, expecting about 10 parents, and about 30 plus showed up. 3 hours later, I asked them to go home and said, I think you've sent a strong message to me that you're interested in something like a Thales Academy. And that's literally where the school was born.
And tell us a little bit about how Thales has grown from just the initial school to now having the eight, and some are in the pipeline to open again.
Yeah, Thales began with about 20 students in 2007. It now has over 3,000 on eight campuses. And we're now, this current year, we'll be opening schools in Virginia, Richmond, and in Nashville, Tennessee area. So the idea of this private school, affordable cost, caring about every student, safe and nurturing, has caught on.
How do all of these schools and others that have been successful in North Carolina, how do they fit in with your general theme that excellent schools are the best community development programs?
I think you can see that in Northern Wake. For example, there hasn't been any public schools built there in recent years. And in fact, there are a half a dozen charter schools now in that area. What's also very interesting is that in spite of all the school choice and all the seats available, everyone is filled up. So as more choice expands, people began to understand it better, that they have multiple choices and they can change their mind year to year. And if you look at the economies of Northern Wake, they're absolutely booming. And school choice is a big factor.
How does this help the families if they know they have this good option for their kids? I imagine that frees them up to do other things that, that also help the economy.
People stop me in the street or in the marketplace over and over, and they often say, you didn't just change the lives of our children, you changed the lives of our family. Because they know that their children are a very safe, nurturing place, and they have the confidence that they're going to have the character formation and the academics to be very successful in life.
What are some of the things that you have learned about a successful school from having gone through this process, both through charter schools and now with private schools? What were some of the things you've learned that you didn't know about education?
Well, I think one of the most important things is character formation is equally as important as academics. So good discipline, a loving discipline is very important to children because it sets them on a glide path for life. Also, parents aren't going to agree with everything the school does. And we often say to them, you're never going to agree with everything we do, but it's a choice. And you have other choices. So think about if parents had 10 or 15 choices in the market, they would make the best choice for their children at that particular point in time. Some parents will come, they may come to K-5 and make another choice in sixth grade. Others will make a different choice in ninth grade. This is all good. And the competition is what makes all businesses and all schools better. Typically, we hear in schooling, they don't like the word competition. But if we didn't have competition in our marketplaces, we wouldn't have the great America that we have today.
You mentioned competition, and I'm glad you did, because it sounds as if there are a lot of options, that also makes the providers have to be better.
Absolutely.
Even if your model is good for some people but not for others, you might have to adapt to make it better for even more.
I think, and it's on the minds of any charter school, private school, we've got to be really good to attract these people because they have many other choices. And in whether it's business and industry or schooling, that's a really good thing, that we have to provide the highest level of service to whoever we're serving possible. And if it's not on our mind, we're going to degrade very quickly.
What do you see as the future for school choice here in North Carolina?
I think school choice is going to grow more rapidly in the future. So we see 100,000 homeschoolers. We see consortiums of homeschoolers working together. We're going to have more private schools. Charter schools are being unleashed. Some of our rural counties have not had the opportunity to have charter schools. So there's a lot of work to be done. But based on all the people that I talk to, they now understand 20 years later, school choice, how important it is. But politically, it's still a major challenge.
Well, it's certainly an interesting topic, and the gentleman we've been speaking with certainly knows of what he speaks. He is founder and chairman of Franklin Academy, St. Thomas More Academy, and the group of schools known as Thales Academy. Bob Luddy, thanks so much for joining us.
Pleasure to be with you, Mitch.
And we'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
Real influence. You either have it or you don't. And at the John Locke Foundation, we have it. You'll find our guiding principles in many of the Freedom Forward reforms of the past decade here in North Carolina. So while others talk or complain or name call, we provide research, solutions, and hope. Our team analyzes the pressing issues of the day, jobs, healthcare, education, and more. We look for effective ways to give you more freedom, more options, more control over your life. Our goal is to transform North Carolina into a growing, thriving economic powerhouse, the envy of every other state. Our research has helped policymakers make decisions that ensure you keep more of what you earn, expand your choice of schools for your kids, widen your job opportunities, improve your access to doctors. The recipe for stability and a bright future. For truth, for freedom, for the future of North Carolina. We are the John Locke Foundation. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio and another edition of Locker Room Talk. I'm Donna Martinez, joined here by my co-host of the program, Mitch Kokai. Mitch, we wanted to take an opportunity to kind of make some observations about the pandemic and what we've seen from government officials and media coverage. And it really got me thinking about this because you wrote a column at CarolinaJournal.com calling for more data and continued analysis of data in the pandemic, and we're getting some of it at the state level. We're getting a lot of it at the federal level, but we need more.
What really sparked this is the fact that almost every news briefing and all of the initial major reports you see in media outlets about the COVID-19 pandemic tend to lead with two statistics: the number of confirmed cases and the number of deaths. And both of those are important statistics, but neither one of them really tells us what we need to know so we can decide what we need to do about the pandemic and the next steps forward. And the way that I went about this in the column was to compare those two main statistics with the two main statistics you tend to see when we have a hurricane. Because this is the thing that most of us are used to when we're dealing with the issues of emergencies and the need for emergency action, is you'll see the governor and his team come out and talk about what's happening in a hurricane, and they often spout two statistics. In that case, one is also deaths, and the other is power outages. And in that case, with a hurricane, when there are deaths with a hurricane, you know it's a big deal. I mean, sometimes there are hurricanes that just kind of go up and down the coast. They do a lot of property damage. That's bad. But they don't kill anyone. And so once a hurricane really leads to deaths, you know it's a big deal and that you kind of need to take precautions because this could affect anyone in the path. And power outages in a hurricane, that gives a great sense of what's happening. What has been knocked out, the power outage number goes up. Then it eventually peaks and then it goes down. And so you know that things are getting back to normal. The statistics that tend to come out with the pandemic are different because the number of deaths doesn't really tell you a whole lot about how that affects the community at large. You'd need to know the difference between the number of deaths of people who are children, working age adults, seniors, people who are perfectly healthy before they get COVID-19 versus people who have some underlying medical condition. You'd want to know that. You'd also want to know a little bit more detail so that you could take the proper precautions. Also, the number of cases doesn't tell you a whole lot because it doesn't give you a percentage of the people of the total population who have the cases. Plus, that number of cases is never going to go down, not like the power outages. I mean, it's always going to go up. And we really need to know, okay, among that larger number, how many people actually have it right now, and what's the danger?
We have had these pretty much daily news conferences from Governor Roy Cooper and Dr. Mandy Cohen, who's the Secretary of Health and Human Services, and they provide the update, and they've given some data, and the Health and Human Services Agency's website also has the basic data that you've talked about, but more and more we have seen reporters, including those from Carolina Journal, push with questions about some of the issues you've talked about and wanting officials to drill down a little bit more deeply so we can have a better sense of the stay-at-home order that the governor put in place through the end of April. Is that justified based on all of the data, not just deaths and confirmed cases? The media coverage has been pretty fascinating with these phone news conferences that we have been seeing. And it makes it difficult for a reporter to follow up, and it makes it difficult for every reporter to get the nuance that you can get from actually being in the room with the official that you are questioning. What do you make of how the coverage has gone?
Yeah, it's certainly a new situation, and we understand why government would do that to keep people from being all clustered together in the same room. In fact, after some of those briefings started, you started to see the public officials themselves realize, oh, we shouldn't all be standing clustered together
right.
when we're telling people to
and
stay
putting
six
our hands all over right, the podium
and telling people to stay yeah. 6 feet apart. So they started doing the distancing. But you're right that this really does limit the ability of an individual reporter to drill down if the answer to his or her question isn't the one that they were really looking for or didn't get into much detail. And it does limit the ability of particular news outlets to get a question asked if the government has the opportunity to control who's getting in and who's getting out. We noticed that for Carolina Journal, Daily tried to get into these briefings and had a hard time. Eventually, Lindsay Marcello, associate editor, was able to get in with a question. But that was after several days of no CJ reporter being able to ask a question, even though they were in the queue every day.
Now, juxtapose that with what's happening at the federal level and the White House. Now, the White House has been holding these daily briefings as well. They have had reporters actually in the room, but social distanced, at least 6 feet apart. The president, the vice president, the medical professionals from the NIH and CDC have been there, and they stand 6 feet apart. So it's different. And the big difference, I think, it gets to that back and forth between reporters and the president or whomever the question has gone to. And it seems to me that's one way that the public gets more information, the back and forth.
Yeah, that's certainly true because, let's face it, politicians often have their stock standard answer. And so you get a question, you're able to get your stock standard answer out there. But sometimes it doesn't actually really answer the question. So the reporter can come back and say, yeah, that's not really what I was asking, or that doesn't quite get to the point I was trying to get you to make. And so and sometimes it's just that the person up there didn't quite understand the question or thought it was something else. And so the chance to ask for a clarification can help get that more information out there. But it certainly is a difference when you have reporters in the room than when they're on the phone and being given an opportunity every once in a while just to chime in.
I've also noticed the difference in the length of these news conferences between Governor Cooper and President Trump. Governor Cooper essentially limiting those news conferences to, say, 30 or 40 minutes. The president, on occasion, has gone on for an hour and a half to 2 hours, and he has been criticized royally by a lot of folks, saying that he has started to turn them into more political statements versus an update on the pandemic. Does any of that hold water for you?
Well, you know, it's probably long to go for a couple of hours, but basically, as long as reporters are asking questions, he's
exactly.
going to answer them. I mean, the reporters, if they had a concern that this was turning into some sort of campaign event, they could all leave. They could say, thank you, Mr. President, and walk out. As long as they're still continuing to ask questions and he's continuing to answer them, I don't know how you call this a campaign event. It's the reporters who are controlling this.
Yeah, I've always found it fascinating that the criticism of the president in this regard, that he talks too much or that he tweets too much. And from a journalist's perspective, I mean, that's gold because it's a primary source who is talking directly to you. And so it seems to me the more access, the better. At least that's what I was taught in journalism school many moons ago. But that you wanted to have that access to a primary source. And yet you have some reporters today who are openly advocating that the president should not be speaking as much.
Yeah, and I think part of that is because people see that when President Trump speaks to people and is unfiltered and it does not go through the media lens, people like what they hear. And for a lot of reporters, they're not too thrilled about that.
Unfortunately, it's the state of journalism, but we will leave that issue to another edition of Carolina Journal Radio. Mitch Kokai, thank you very much.
Thanks, Donna.
That's all the time we have for the program this week. I'm Donna Martinez. On behalf of Mitch and me and the entire Carolina Journal Radio team, we hope you'll join us again next week for another edition. Have a good week, everybody.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.